You are listening to a podcast from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
Well, good afternoon, everyone, and let me welcome you to Carnegie. My name's Jim Collins. I run the Russia-Eurasia program here at Carnegie. And we are very pleased today to have a panel to discuss the current state of the efforts to change the relationship between Turkey and Armenia. Last year, as I think everyone here knows, there was a substantial step taken to normalize the relationship between Armenia and Turkey in the signature of protocols. And since that time, efforts have been made to move forward with those protocols. And there have been both positive but also some very serious negative developments over the time. And I think those of us who want to see this project succeed have been thinking about what should be done, perhaps to give some greater impetus to keep this process alive, and to think about whether there are additional ways that the process can be encouraged. And so we have a panel today to talk about that, and there is a paper also, which I think if you have not, I hope you will pick up outside. It's called Armenia and Turkey, Bridging the Gap. It's by my colleague Tom DeWall, who has recently joined us at Carnegie as our senior associate dealing with the South Caucasus. But I am not going to spend a great deal of time introducing the panel. We have Henri Barclay, we have David Phillips, and we have Tom DeWall, who will be speaking to you today. You have their biographies in the invitation. And so I am, it's my role here only to try to moderate and keep the proceedings in an orderly fashion. And so without further taking up anyone's time, I'm going to turn the floor to our first speaker, Henri Barclay. Henri?
thanks, Jim. I don't know why I picked a short straw and I'm going first, but be that as it may. What I've been asked to do is kind of look at this from try to explain the Turkish, not explain the Turkish perspective, but analyze the Turkish perspective. And what I will try and do is just give a quick, if you want, an analytical background, and then leave to what can be done to the question and answer period. So at least in the first segment, don't expect answers for me. Actually, I want to wait what the others are going to say so I can figure out what I'm going to say. But anyway, jokes aside, look, where are we now? I mean, clearly, the Armenian-Turkish reconciliation process is on life support. But it's on life support, but it's not dead yet. And as we know from, shall we say, the medical profession, one can be on life support for a very long period of time, and things can get better later. And maybe in the short run, especially as the Turks go into their election cycle, and one can argue that they're already in their election cycle, not much may be done. And the trick will be to figure out what it is we can do to make this life support system work as efficiently and not revert back to a worse condition. In other words, for it not to die. So let me try to explain why it is, at least from my perspective, why is it that the Turks engaged in this Armenian protocols business? In a way, it was quite surprising. It started with the Turkish President Abdullah Gül accepting an invitation to go to a soccer game in Yerevan, and in of itself, this was a very, very important and psychological step. a step that was ferociously condemned by the by most of the opposition in Turkey, and as if President Gül was accepting something that was inconceivable. That said, you know, he's in a way he started a process, but I think ultimately Gül was part of a much bigger change in thinking in Turkey. This Turkish government, the AKP government, of which Gül had been a foreign minister, has came to power at the end of 2002 with very, very big ideas and very ambitious ideas. And part of this ambitious idea is about Turkey's role in the world. And initially, it couldn't do that much because first there was that something, that little thing called the Iraq War that affected Turkish policy soon after the AKP government came to power. So as Iraq progressed, as the government found its bearings, it started to put into place this policy. And let me just quickly address the two aspects of why Armenia, and then I put all this in a much larger context. When you look at why the protocols were signed last year, there are basically two reasons. The one is the easy reason. I mean, it happened just before the April 24, the time when the President of the United States always makes a declaration whether or not he was going to use the G word, the genocide word, this year, considering the fact that President Obama had committed himself during the campaign on numerous occasions that he was going to recognize the events of 1915 as a genocide, and considering the fact that Secretary of State Clinton, when she was a senator, the Speaker of the House, the Vice President, you name it, everybody in the Democratic hierarchy had committed themselves to the G word. So here comes the first, April 24th, and having already done the opening with Abdullah Gül, the government, Turkish government, essentially agreed to do the Armenian opening with the hope that obviously the G word would not be used, and in the end, that came out to be correct, and the president used the Armenian word that means great catastrophe, which is the way the Armenians have in the past have referred to it, and so the crisis was averted because the consequences clearly of such a crisis in Turkish-American relations would have been, especially with a new Obama administration, would have been catastrophic for Turkey. At least that's how the Turks thought about it. But that's in many ways is the easy answer. But I think there's a much more complicated answer, and I think irrespective of President Obama's election or the question of the use of the G word, the fact of the matter is I think the Turks were thinking and were moving in a new direction. And this is what we need to understand. That doesn't mean it's going to happen. I'm not saying that necessarily the protocols will ever be signed. I mean, I think they will, but they may not. But so what is it? So we hear a lot about this new Turkish approach, zero problems with the neighbors. And clearly, when you look at what the Turks have done since under AKP, they have improved relations with just about everybody. The only two neighbors, so to say, are Armenia and Cyprus. And it depends how you count Cyprus, since it's not exactly territorially adjacent to Turkey. But at least Armenia sticks out like a sore thumb in this. Now, having zero problems with your neighbors is also a very simplistic way. I mean, as a friend of mine the other day said to me, you know, who wants to have bad relations with their neighbors? I mean, we all want to have good relations with our neighbors. I mean, it's not, but in a way, maybe I think it's an unfortunate use of the words. But in Turkey's case, given the legacy of the empire, et cetera, clearly Turkey's relations with all of its neighbors have been problematic for a variety of reasons. So in that sense, maybe in a Turkish context, having zero problems with your neighbors actually means something that doesn't mean, let's say, for the United States. Now, but again, more fundamentally, so what the Turks have tried to do is to project themselves into international politics, into global politics, into making themselves a country that punches above its weight, or at least punches at its weight. Because for many, many years, Turkish foreign policy has been very, very timid. Turkish foreign policy has been mostly reactive. Turkish foreign policy has never gone out of its very comfortable little cocoon. And now you have a government that says, not only we have to change that, but we want to be somebody. We want to be somebody in the sense that Turkey is now is the 17th largest economy in the world. It is a member of the G20 as a result. For the first time in 50 years, it has a seat at the UN Security Council. The last time was in 1960 when it shared its seat with Poland. And, you know, just because you want to be a member of the Security Council, it's not as you call the Secretary General and said, okay, this is my year. It takes time. It takes investment. It takes work. It takes effort. And the Turks put an enormous amount of effort, opening embassies in all of Africa, Latin America, improving relations with a whole variety of countries, building essentially a coalition. But this is all part of making Turkey an important international player. And to that extent, they have succeeded. Right? They have succeeded in many ways, you can argue, beyond everybody's wildest imagination. Maybe they're gone, too. But at the same time, with this, shall we say, improving image, there was this problem of Armenia. And Armenia is a small country. Armenia is economically is not important, certainly for the 17th largest economy of the world. Armenia politically may not be that important either. But it was important in one very important respect. Not just because of the zero problems with the neighbors, but psychologically, ever since the end of the Cold War, the issue of the genocide has become more and more important. It's become an issue that has been dogging Turkish foreign policy more and more. Even before the Cold War ended, you will say this issue was important. But I would say qualitatively, the situation has changed. So from a Turkish perspective, if you want to be an important power in the world, if you want to have a moral authority, sure, you have to fix your problems at home. But beyond that, the stigma of the genocide had to be dealt with. Right. Now, it isn't that the Turks are going to change their mind about whether or not it's been a they committed genocide or not. It's not as if the Armenians are going to change their mind about this. But at least the perception of the creation of a process of reconciliation would help take some of the edge of that stigma. Because with that stigma, you cannot proceed along this dimension. And this is something that I think this Turkish leadership came to realize. I mean, you also see, I mean, they've dropped a lot of hints. They've talked a great deal about other issues that tells you that in terms of how they think. For example, one of the issues in which they have brought up is why resolve the domestic Kurdish problem? Well, because you can't become a global power when you have such a serious problem at home. And the Armenian question is one that dogs you internationally, in Europe. Everywhere you go, you get slapped by this. Again, as I said, there's not going to be much of a change in official positions on either side. But at least this gives you an opportunity to start taking the edge off the scene. And ultimately, I think this is the real reason why the protocols were signed. But as much as this was the ambition, clearly this is not a very popular movement. I mean, this is not a popular policy in Turkey. Not only it's not popular with the opposition, but I discount the Turkish, at least parliamentary opposition, because the Turkish parliamentary opposition is the best. I don't know how to describe it. I mean, if you say this is white, they're going to say black. If you say it's black, they'll say it's white. I mean, it's not a very constructive opposition. So I'm not sure what it is sometimes they believe in genuinely, at least the leadership of the opposition, the social democratic opposition. That said, and I'll leave Tom to talk about what happens within Armenia, but at least within Turkey, this was not very popular, because generally people don't want to be any concession, quote unquote, on the genocide issue is seen as losing face. But it is the problem for the government is that that opposition is actually quite significant within its own party as well. I mean, the AKP is a Turkish nationalist party, and it is not. It is not going to give up on the basic tenets of this. Now, of course, the other problem is that what the Turks did not anticipate, and is that there would be a major Azeri reaction. And the Azeri reaction came very quickly and very ferociously. I'm not privy to what happened in the conversations between the Turks and the Armenians, or certainly between the Turks and the Azeris, but at least indications are that the Azeris did not really think that the Turks would sign the protocols, that they would talk about them, they would engage in the process, but somehow they would not be signed. Or at least the impression that the Turks may have given to the Azeris as, yes, if we sign them, but this is also contingent on movement in the Nagorno-Karabakh issue. But, of course, the protocols had no preconditions. Nagorno-Karabakh was not discussed, not mentioned in the protocols. So when the ferocious reaction took place, the Turkish prime minister, and this is where I'm not sure whether this was a pre-planned announcement or because he has a tendency of talking off the cuff, he responded by saying, of course, Nagorno-Karabakh is a precondition. So in effect, for the first time, somebody put a precondition on the signing of the protocols. And that started the process, but I think initially, as far as I can see, the Armenians did not necessarily react very negatively. People tended to ignore it. The real reaction came, of course, after the Armenian Constitutional Court ruled on this on the protocols and said that the protocols were in accordance with the Armenian Declaration of Independence and the Armenian Constitution, and therefore you can go ahead and submit them to the parliament and get them ratified. At that point, it looked like pressure had moved on to the Turks and that the Turks had to do something because both countries had agreed, as you know, to submit them to their parliaments. The Armenians did, pending the court decision, and the Turks had sent them but did not actually introduce them in their parliament. So the Turks had to do something. And that's when I think the Turks panicked, at least the government panicked, and then pointed out to a line in the, not in the decision of the court, but in the discussion that the court published, saying that the Republic of Armenia stands in support of the task of achieving international recognition of the 1915 genocide in Ottoman Turkey and Western Armenia. This is paragraph 11 of the Armenian Declaration. And the Turks then said, you see, they're talking about the G word, therefore they have put a precondition. But part of the protocols, as you know, talks about the creation of a historical commission. Now, the Armenians are not going to not agree to a historical commission because they want to prove to the rest of the world that the genocide did not occur, and vice versa. The Turks are not going to agree to something because they want to prove to the rest of the world that the genocide did occur. Right? I mean, this is part of the process. It was an obfuscation. But to suddenly say that because of the reference to the Armenian Declaration of Independence, which the Turks knew existed, I mean, it's not created a crisis, and that's where we are now, because then the rest of the reaction to that was actually very negative, not only in Armenia, but also in the United States. And that, in some ways, I believe, allowed for the House International Relations Committee to have that vote, the 23-22 vote about the sending the genocide resolution to the floor. And then very quickly, we know that Erdogan made another, shall we say, unfortunate comment about kicking out 100,000 Armenian illegal workers in Turkey. Of course, there are no 100,000 Armenian illegal workers. There's maybe 12,000 at most. And that kind of saw the region. And this is where we are. I mean, the Turks are now going into an election cycle. Elections will take place in July of 2011. So it seems to me that not much is going to happen in the interim, unless there's a major breakthrough on the Nagorno-Karabakh issue, but that's Tom's bailiwick. Thank you.
Henry, thank you very much. David, could I turn the floor to you? You will explain to us how to reconcile these.
Thank you, Ambassador Collins, and thank you, Tom, for your invitation. My remarks today will focus on the role of civil society, the activities of the Turkish-Armenian Reconciliation Commission, which I chaired, lessons from TARC's experience, and the role of civil society going forward. When the TARC was launched in 2001, it was the first structured dialogue between Turks and Armenians about reconciliation issues since the end of the Ottoman Empire. It was born out of work that I had done as a senior advisor for the State Department for Mark Grossman, focusing on Greek and Turkish issues. We brought together a number of Greek and Turkish working groups to collaborate in different areas. My partner in that area, in that project, was Ahmet Evin, who's here with us today. One of the activities that we did was a shared history project in which we looked at what the Greeks call the burning of Smyrna, what the Turks refer to as the fire of Izmir. Ambassador Grossman asked if we could do a similar kind of shared history project for Turks and Armenians. He warned me at the time that would be my hardest assignment yet, but rather naively enthusiastic, I accepted it. I got a little taste of how difficult it would be when I sat down with Van Krikorian and Bob Kalustian and started to talk to them about shared history. And they made very clear from the very beginning that there is no shared history when it comes to the Turkish and Armenian narrative. There's only one version of history, and that is the history of the Armenian genocide. Let me just clarify some facts about TARC, because there's been a lot of speculation concerning the commission over the years. The U.S. government was not involved in the design or the development of TARC. It encouraged TARC's creation. It brought me into the process. It performed some initial liaison with Turkish and Armenian officials, but at no point did anyone from the State Department seek to instruct me how to run TARC's affairs. They probably knew that had they tried to do so, that I would have rejected their instruction. The U.S. government was the largest funder of TARC. Other governments also joined in supporting it, the governments of the United Kingdom, Sweden, Austria, and the Swiss authorities. At every stage, from the conceptualization through the completion of TARC's work, I maintained regular and close contact with Turkish and Armenian officials. None of this was done without the knowledge of the capitals in Ankara and Yerevan. In fact, both governments took an active role in trying to counsel me, trying to influence me in our approach. There was never any payment to TARC members. There was no compensation for them. In fact, the exact opposite was true. They probably deprived themselves of opportunity as a result of their work with the commission. And there was never a moment in TARC's deliberations where the commissioners had a discussion whether or not the Armenian genocide did or did not occur. We tried to be more present and forward-looking, fully recognizing that history had a significant impact on how we would conduct our work in the future. There were a number of problems with TARC. Let me kind of be candid and quick about them. After a year's worth of discrete meetings, we announced TARC's creation. We had hoped to coincide the announcement with a decision in Ankara to normalize the visa regime for Armenian passport holders so they could get visas at the airport. The timing of that didn't work out the way we had hoped. It occurred 10 months after the announcement of TARC. Had that occurred, it would have created an atmosphere of progress. Soon after TARC's announcement were the attacks of 9/11 and the new focus on the war on terror and Turkey's indispensable role. The approach of Turks and Armenians in TARC were totally different. The Armenians were always in a hurry to get something done, to show progress and results. The Turks were very process-oriented. In fact, if TARC continued its work to this day without having achieved any specific milestones, I think it would have been much to the satisfaction of the Turkish participants. We always had a hard time dealing with the media. I tried to adopt media principles, which were in fact brought on board by TARC after its announcement, but there was no way of enforcing those. We got along very well when we were together as a group, but as Ilter Turkmen, the former foreign minister, said, at the moment that we went public, it seemed as though both sides started speaking to their constituencies. We didn't do a very good job of managing the public diplomacy side of that. There was this perception that the United States government was in control of the process. As I said earlier, that wasn't the case, but that was a constant allegation that was raised about TARC that was used to discredit it. The selection of the TARC members that deliberately excluded Dashnaks was my decision entirely. I can assure you that if we had extremist nationalists from either the Armenian or Turkish side, that our discussions would have ended in 10 minutes' time. So what we tried to do is to have strong nationalist representatives from both, people like Andranik Megranian on the Armenian side, people like Gündüz Aktan on the Turkish side, but we deliberately excluded those that I would put into the ultra-nationalist camp. I was also accused throughout of being too robust a chairman. That may have indeed been the case, but I think at the end of the day, I succeeded in pissing both sides off equally, which may be some measure of success in this kind of work. So I would not have changed my demeanor or approach in any stretch of the word. The benefits of TARC. When we announced it, it became a lightning rod. It attracted a lot of criticism, mostly from the Armenian side, which was to my surprise. I thought it would be the Turks who would push back, but it was the Armenians who, in fact, went wobbly, and their support for TARC was not as strong as I expected it to be. We did create a safe space for other NGO activities. Keep in mind that when we started our discussion, there was literally no contact going on between Turks and Armenians. At the end of TARC's tenure in 2004, Track 2 activities became a virtual industry. Part of that was the funding of the American University's Track 2 program for Turkey and the Caucasus. We made dozens and dozens of sub-grants to Turkish and Armenian NGO groups who wanted to work together. There were inherent difficulties in doing so. Part of that was lacking the resource, so we developed a grant program in order to finance their activities on a fast track. We initially focused on cultural events, things like bringing the Ankara String Quartet to Yerevan, where there were protests, by the way, upon their arrival, Armenian folk dancers coming to Turkey. There were civil society partnerships, the Turkish-Armenian Business Council, the Chambers of Commerce heads from Van and Gumri, local mayors, parliamentarians, media associations, women's groups, youth groups, student groups, professors, you name it. It was just an extraordinary plethora of joint activities that were stimulated by the announcement of TARC and then funded through the AU program. In fact, in his public remarks on TARC, Ambassador Grossman said to me, I asked you to start a dialogue and you catalyze a social movement. So if Track 2 is in fact trying to create a social movement, we were able to do so. We also were able to stimulate official contact between Turkish and Armenian officials. Prior to TARC, there was none. When TARC was announced, soon thereafter, there were a series of contacts. I won't enumerate them, but they were on the margins of the World Economic Forum, the General Assembly, the NATO Ministerial. Armenia opened an office in Istanbul with the Black Sea Economic Cooperation Council. Armenia was able to join the World Trade Organization, so there was an impact in official circles on what TARC was doing as a civil society initiative. Perhaps the greatest contribution that TARC was able to make was the legal analysis that TARC's commissioners sought through the International Center for Transitional Justice on, quote, the applicability of the Genocide Convention to events in the early 20th century. It took a year to negotiate the terms of reference to conduct that legal analysis. It took another year to perform it. You can imagine all the traps and ambushes involved in doing this kind of work. But ultimately, we released a legal finding, obviously non-binding, that in my mind was a win-win. It had something in it for both parties. For Turks, the legal finding stated very clearly and unequivocally that the Genocide Convention was intended to provide prospective obligation on its signatories. And therefore, any effort to apply the Genocide Convention to seek reparations or to make territorial claims would be null and void in international law. No such treaty has ever been applied retroactively. It did acknowledge that there were other instruments, including civil legal actions, that could be used to seek reparations, but it eliminated the use of the Genocide Convention in any kind of reparation or territorial claim process. There was also a finding there that was much to the liking of the Armenian participants. The legal eagles involved in the process have studied the founding statute of the ICC in Rome, the ad hoc tribunals for Rwanda and Yugoslavia, and created a definition of genocide. More than one person died. Those persons belonged to a particular ethnic, racial, or religious group. There was a pattern to their killing, and the perpetrators of their killing had the intent to kill them. Now, the issue that has been primarily contested was the intent on the Turkish side. And the finding concluded that since the Ottoman rulers clearly knew when they ordered the deportation of up to 2 million Armenians from the Ottoman Empire, that more than one person would die, that the events, in fact, met the definition of genocide, and that journalists, scholars, and historians would be entitled to apply the term genocide to those events. Given the amount of effort that we put into developing this legal analysis, it was welcomed with remarkable silence. Unlike the announcement of TARC, which was greeted with a lot of hullabaloo on both sides, there was very little notice of the legal analysis. And to my mind, it represents a way forward that has not yet been fully appreciated or manifest, and its full value has yet to be realized. We initially thought that the commission was going to operate for a year. It, in fact, operated for 4 years. I'm grateful to Ted Sorensen, who chaired the legal analysis, and the Center for Transitional Justice for their help. After 4 years, President Bush, in his executive statement on April 4th, commended TARC for its work, and we decided to disband our activities and to issue a set of final recommendations. In short, those recommendations called for full bilateral diplomatic relations between Turkey and Armenia, opening the border for normal travel and trade, and that the governments of Turkey and Armenia should openly support civil society, including contacts between a range of different technical groups and religious leaders and in the field of disaster preparedness. If you read the final recommendations of TARC, it reads as an early document of the protocols. The protocols that were signed on October 10th mirror the final conclusions of TARC, both in spirit and letter. So where do we go from here? Let me just very briefly give an analysis of what I think the situation is, and then talk a little bit about civil society's role going forward. I would say that there is almost no likelihood that the Turkish parliament is going to ratify the protocols in the next couple of weeks, or even in the next couple of months. The Armenian government has made it very clear that they're not going to allow the signing of the protocols to be used as a delaying tactic, and they have passed legislation in their parliament to rescind their signature from the protocols if, in fact, they are not ratified. The Armenian government has said they're prepared to ratify it in one business day. When the next week President Sarkisian is here for the nuclear summit, I'm sure that on Tuesday when he sees President Obama, this is going to be a major topic of discussion. And he will, of course, encourage the president to use the genocide term in his presidential statement on April 24th. I would imagine that the White House is going to respond by saying, please don't rescind your signature. Give us a little time. And the Armenian government will say, you can have a little time just out of respect for the office and you as a person, but that is not an open-ended process. I would guess that within 30 days after the April 24th anniversary, if there is not ratification, that we're going to see the signatures rescinded. And then there's a major train wreck that happens. All the progress that TARC worked on, that the panelists have worked on, that you all have been a part of, is going to be set back significantly. So we need to think a little bit about the role for civil society. Let's say there is ratification. Civil society is going to play a key role consolidating progress, building on successes. If there isn't ratification, civil society interaction, contact, and cooperation is going to become more of a safety net. How do we make sure that safety net is fully established? There needs to be a systematic assessment of Track 2 activities over the past 10 years as a strategy for developing a program going forward. That assessment hasn't occurred. The U.S. embassies in Yerevan and in Ankara haven't been doing contingency planning the way I would have hoped. Now's the time to think strategically about how do you mitigate a problem in the event that the train wreck occurs. One way to do that is to recapitalize this Track 2 fund and to make sure that there are funds available to Turkish and Armenian groups that are ready to work together. There is a pot of money at the U.S. Embassy in Yerevan that's dedicated for cross-border activities. That money has been in their account for some time. From my mind, that should have been allocated long ago, but now is the time to accelerate the distribution of those funds. U.S. Embassy Ankara also has RFPs that it has issued or will be issuing for a range of different areas like university cooperation, media partnerships, cultural cooperation. Very important to push those grants out the door as soon as possible. There also can be better cooperation between our embassies in Ankara and Yerevan. There should be regular meetings between officials of the two, USAID officials from Yerevan, the PAO, and the public affairs staff in Ankara should be meeting in the respective capitals, making sure that things are well coordinated. The U.S. can also lead the creation of a donor affinity group on civil society initiatives. With another European country, they can look to raise additional funds, make those funds available to civil society organizations, make sure that what is already going to be difficult work isn't made more difficult by the lack of material resources. These are just a few strategies for trying to consolidate progress or cushion the blow. TARC went through a difficult endeavor. There are important lessons to be learned from its efforts, and now is a good moment to reflect and apply those as we go forward, which is why I welcomed your invitation to participate today. So thank you all.
Okay. Thank you, David. Next, we'll hear from Tom DeWall, who is the author of the paper and has some thoughts about the problem we will and how we might approach it if, in fact, we don't have these protocols dealt with effectively.
Thanks very much, Jim. I suppose I'm going to talk mostly about the Caucasus. I think what was very positive about the protocols was that this was a positive dynamic working for the Caucasus. Suddenly, Turkey, I think, and Henri partly said this, but I would go further and say Turkey deciding it wanted to be a neutral, disinterested player in the Caucasus, and it couldn't be that if the border with Armenia was closed. And then Russia also welcoming that, another historical development, Russia beginning to see Turkey not as a historical rival in the Caucasus, but as a potential partner. And this was a very positive dynamic which was propelling this process forward. Unfortunately, what we see happening is, I think, the perpetual curse of the Caucasus. So maybe this should be the title of a new Harry Potter book. It just always seems to be coming back and back. That short-term negative dynamics always seem to frustrate positive progress forward. It's as though the region is still stuck in the late 80s and early 90s, the period of kind of nationalism, of conflict, in which the default position that people take is a defensive posture. It's a hedgehog posture that we want to protect ourselves, we want to defend ourselves, and we're very cautious about moving forward. I was in Yerevan last month, and I was expecting a much more positive atmosphere in Yerevan about the potential for opening the border with Turkey. I mean, this is its largest border. It's its border to Europe. It's a border with a country that is a member of the EU customs union. Trade would be transformed. And yet, there's still a lot of skepticism about this, still this hedgehog posture. Those Turks are trying to deceive us, or even the shops of Yerevan will be flooded with cheap Turkish goods. A lot of people who, amazingly enough, want that border to stay closed. I don't think that's the majority view, but it's a surprisingly large minority view. So that negative dynamic has affected people's minds to that extent. And obviously, we've got the great volcano, sleeping volcano of the Caucasus, which is the Nagorno-Karabakh conflict between Armenia and Azerbaijan. And this dynamic is particularly visible in the Armenian-Azerbaijan conflict. Great hesitancy to move forward, to take bold steps. Leaders on both sides much preferring to live with the status quo unsatisfactory as it is rather than move forward into the future. I don't necessarily blame the leaders for taking this posture. It is a very risky proposition to sign on a dotted line if you're an Armenian or Azerbaijani leader. It would transform your country and in very positive ways, but it is a risky thing to do. So maybe the question is more to the international community, to Europe and the United States and Russia and Turkey, about why aren't you doing enough to hold the hands of the Armenians and the Azerbaijanis? Why aren't you underpinning the Karabakh peace process with more resources? Let's think for a moment about this conflict. It's such a big problem that it's almost paradoxically invisible. It's the longest border in the Caucasus, the two countries in the Caucasus which have no relations. They have a ceasefire line between them, which is more than 110 miles long, with more than 20,000 soldiers on either side, monitored by just six European monitors. So a ceasefire that basically exists and persists on with the goodwill only of the sides. We have long-running negotiations which enormous resources have been invested in. Sitting at the back of the room is Kerry Kavanaugh, of the former US co-chair, who did a lot at Key West, got very close with French and Russian support, but was frustrated along with the French and the Russians. Again, the local dynamics frustrating international mediation. If this conflict were to reignite, I don't think it will tomorrow, but if it was to reignite down the line, this would be a catastrophe which would take in the whole of the Caucasus. It would touch Iran, Turkey, Russia. It would be an absolute catastrophe for a very wide region. So why is no progress being made? Well, there's this cautious international approach. The tail wags the dog in the Caucasus. Why get involved? Why risk? Why take the risk of moving forward? And always the skillful use by the local actors, playing off the international actors against each other, using their bilateral ties, and preventing forward progress. The Turkey-Armenia process was like a breath of fresh air. It threatened to change all this, to open up the Caucasus in a new way. Now, understandably, Azerbaijan felt very nervous. Azerbaijan has around one-seventh of its de jure territory under foreign control, under Armenian control. Azerbaijan has been accustomed to seeing the closure of the Turkish border as leverage on Armenia over the Karabakh conflict. So the logic goes, if the border opens, then Armenia is freer, Armenia is under less pressure, it will have less interest in giving up the occupied territories, and we, Azerbaijan, lose. And so this was the basic attitude about why Azerbaijan moved in heavily and pretty successfully to try and block forward movement in the Turkey-Armenia normalization process. I can understand that. I can understand what the Azeris are saying, but I would argue this is part of the same term, same short-term, narrow, negative thinking in the Caucasus. Actually, think about it in the longer term, maybe in the short term indeed. It's worse for the Karabakh process. The Karabakh peace process is actually deadlocked at the moment, partly because no one quite knows how the Armenia-Turkey process will play itself out. But in the longer term, this will undoubtedly be a positive dynamic. It will remove the siege mentality from Armenia. It will encourage Azerbaijan to look more constructively towards Armenia. If Turkey is doing it, why shouldn't Azerbaijan? And Turkey will have a lot more leverage over Armenia than it does at the present by having an open border and an ambassador in Yerevan, and will be able to exert much more positive pressure than it does at the moment if the border is open. So, unfortunately, though, the Caucasian dynamics seem to have spread to Ankara, and we do see this deadlock happening at the moment. And I would argue that similar negative dynamics have affected the whole April 24th genocide debate here in Washington, that, again, I understand fully the Armenian diaspora, where it's coming from. For them, the genocide, the fate of their grandfathers is the defining issue. And yet, look at the tactics. Have they worked? All these genocide resolutions, threats of genocide resolutions, have they made anything different in Turkey? No, they haven't. Turkey has become more defensive. Turkey recalls its ambassador. Turkey lashes back. What has made a difference is the kind of things David has been talking about, these civil society activities, a growing debate within Turkey, Turkish columnists and thinkers now openly talking about the Armenian question, Orhan Pamuk raising the issue. You can read the word genocide now in Turkish newspapers and people don't get prosecuted for it. So, in a sense, we have to accept that there's a debate within Turkey, and the Armenian diaspora has not caught up with that. And surely it's far better to have a dialogue with Turkey than to get the rather pyrrhic victory of a genocide resolution through Congress. Unfortunately, the negative dynamics again seem to have made this the issue rather than actually describing and understanding what happened in 1915, the issue. And so in my paper, I argue that on this issue, what makes sense is to look forward, to 2015, which is 5 years' time, the anniversary of the 1915 events, the genocide, the great catastrophe, and say, actually, say to the Turks, well, in 5 years' time, the whole world will be marking this centenary. And you should have we should be giving you a 5 years' pause to think about this, come up with a better response than the one you've got at the moment. But take off the short-term pressure, but remind them that in 5 years' time, this centenary is coming. And invite them to be part of the 2015 centenary and say, we want to mark this with you and not without you. Work on this civil society activity, work on this dialogue within Turkey, and try and make this, again, a positive dynamic rather than a negative one. Thank you.
Well, thank you all. And I think we have plenty of material here to engage the audience. And so that's where I'd like to turn now. I would appreciate it if you can identify yourself if you want to pose a question to the panel. And wait for the microphone when you do so. So I'm ready for people from the audience. Yes, let's start here in the front.
Hello, thank you for your presentations. Kate Nahapetian with the Armenian National Committee of America. I was wondering what understanding does each panelist have of the Armenian genocide? It seems some of you were careful in how you were talking about it. And I think it's very important for us to understand your background on the Armenian genocide, since you're proposing recommendations of steps forward, and the fact that you were surprised that people in Armenia weren't very enthusiastic about the border being open, I think maybe reflects a lack of understanding of the Armenian genocide for them to know that there 1.5 million people could be murdered and people couldn't even talk about it today, and the state that's bordering them is denying it and actually accusing Armenians of genocide. I mean, if you understand that, I think you might appreciate why they're not that enthusiastic about it. And it seems the protocols are not moving forward, and that the recommendation should be to pursue Armenia's offer, which has been for several years, to normalize relations without any preconditions. You don't need and you don't need protocols to do that. Turkey was able to establish relations without having to have protocols that would need to be ratified by the parliament. That's the problem. They should normalize relations in a process that doesn't need to be ratified through a parliamentary procedure.
Right. Well, let me have the panel.
Okay. And then my question is the TARC study on the legal aspects of the genocide. If you could tell us who the author is, we've tried to find out who that is and are not able to find out. They've kept it anonymous, and I was wondering why that's the case.
Maybe, David, could you at least start off with the last question?
Yeah, the author of the legal analysis is anonymous, and he or she remains anonymous at the author's request. I would just push back on one thing that you said, Tom. You referred to the efforts of the Armenian diaspora to gain recognition of the Armenian genocide. From my visit to Armenia on April 24th, I didn't see any separation between Armenians within Armenia and Armenians in the diaspora. I think that Armenians worldwide are bonded together through this common historical experience. I think it's a mischaracterization to say that recognition efforts are undertaken by the diaspora. The constitution of Armenia and Armenian political leaders are clear on this matter. And then you asked for clarity about the positions of the panelists vis-a-vis the Armenian genocide.
Our expertise, what studies have they done, what's their background on the issue?
Then my background is explained on the pages of my book on Silencing the Past. I'll refer you to that.
Okay. Like anyone else who, you know, visits Armenia and takes an interest in the Caucasus, I've just, you know, read widely on the issue. I spend a lot of time in Armenia. David's right that the Armenian government also sets a priority on recognition of the genocide, but it's not its number one priority. I would say for the diaspora, it is the number one priority. The majority of people in Armenia do want to see the border open. I was on a flight from Yerevan to Istanbul with a lot of businessmen who are all desperate for that border to be open so they can trade directly with between Turkey and Armenia, not via Georgia. Armenian-Turkish relations are actually much better than Armenian-Azerbaijani relations. And so I think this seems to be one of those situations where everyone wants the other side to move first. Some positive steps have been taken, and then we suddenly hit a roadblock, and then everyone is saying, well, you move first. And as an outsider, you can see that everyone will benefit if they do meet in the middle, but unfortunately we're at a roadblock.
Andre, did you want to add anything?
Look, I mean, you're asking what expertise do people have. I mean, one works in a certain area, and that one doesn't have necessarily expertise in every. I am not a historian. I don't claim to be one or play one on television. But in many respects, this word genocide has been really politicized. If you go by the definition that David just the anonymous decision or an analysis, so to say, yes, it is a genocide. Whether or not one should have it politically recognized by a U.S. Congress or any other parliament is another matter. I have said many times in the past that it's none of the business of the U.S. Congress to pass a resolution like that. But whether or not I think in that, given that definition, yes, it's a genocide. Whether or not it applies, and I think whether the convention applies, I don't think it applies. But then again, I'm not a lawyer either.
Yes, second row, and then I'll come to you.
Thank you, gentlemen, for the presentations. My name is Arsen Kharach, and I'm from the Voice of American Armenian Service. Question about the process of the Armenian-Turkish protocols decoupling Nagorno-Karabakh issue. Apparently, this is the highest level when many who doubted that it's possible to go forward between in the relations between Armenia and Turkey without Nagorno-Karabakh included seem to be failing. This is going nowhere, as we see. Some were suggesting in 30 days. After April 24th, you were suggesting that it will go only for 30 days and the Armenian side will call it back. So with this regard, if we were to talk about lessons learned, can we say that the two processes are impossible to decouple and go forward with? And if yes or not, and if yes, then should we make it a big package deal and go forward with a package deal? Thank you.
Tom,
go ahead.
Respond to that. Clearly, this is the tricky issue. The Turkish side wants the two issues to be coupled. Although then it was a mistake really to sign the protocols without flagging that up, and the Armenian side clearly doesn't want them to be coupled. So you have to have some creative formula in between. It's impossible, I think, to expect the Armenian president, Serzh Sarkisyan, he is himself a Karabakh Armenian. Karabakh is a much bigger issue for Yerevan than the Turkish border. Expect him to make concessions on the Karabakh issue for the sake of the Turkish border, like giving up territories. I just don't see that happening. One idea that I mentioned in the paper, which is also discussed by Burcu, what's her second name, Burcu Gültenkin Puntsman, in another paper, is the idea that you could focus on Nahichevan, the Azerbaijani exclave, that Armenia could, in tandem with the opening of the border, Armenia could free communications with the Azerbaijani exclave of Nahichevan. For those of you who are not so familiar with the geography, there's a map which would explain to you why that would make sense. But I also think there's an international role here. I do, as I said earlier, I do think it's up for the international community to step up here and start treating the Caucasus a bit like they used to treat the Balkans in the 1990s, really saying, admitting that if you are going to fix these problems, you have to invest many more resources in them. So it's a matter of an international statement that we suddenly take this Karabakh issue much more seriously.
Okay. David?
When you read the protocols, there is no mention of Azerbaijan or Nagorno-Karabakh anywhere in the text. There's no mention in any of the annexes. When I sat with the Assistant Secretary of State immediately after the initialing of the protocols, he was gleeful about the fact that there had been a procedural breakthrough, which is that the protocols had de-linked progress on Nagorno-Karabakh with normalization and recognition. I expect that when President Obama visited Turkey in early April of last year, that this matter was discussed. There must have been some understandings that shaped his remarks to the Turkish Grand National Assembly on April 7th of last year. So from a legal and technical perspective, the breakthrough is that there's no linkage. The reality is that on a spiritual level, those issues are integrally linked. And the fact that Prime Minister Erdogan, weeks after the president's address to the parliament, went to Baku and addressed the parliament there and reaffirmed the linkage was contrary to both the letter of the protocols and the understandings that had been discussed with U.S. officials. So if we're going to return to that understanding, we have to refer to the documents themselves, but we also have to understand that there is a metaphysical connection for both sides that we cannot disassociate.
Henri?
the protocols and had a great deal of ambiguity attached to them, and that was obviously deliberate. But where we are today, I think it's kind of difficult to see how we can put together a package, grand bargain, so to say, or whatever you want to call it. I said on the outset of my comments that this was on life support, and we should actually figure out a way of keeping it on life support until a better remedy appears. And it seems to me that the way probably to do it for the time being is for the Turks to say, frankly, look, we're having problems at home. Let's delay this. How you put this diplomatically, I don't know. But it's very clear that there was a delegation of Turkish journalists and think tankers who went to Armenia the other day and spent a long time there. And the message that they got, and this was a fairly senior delegation, the message that they got says, look, things, just say that you can't do it now and we'll live with it. And I think we need to figure out a way for that to happen, because the protocols are not going to move. Nagorno-Karabakh is not going to be solved anytime soon. Right? We just need to figure out a way of keeping it alive.
And I think that may be true for the think tankers and journalists, but I don't think that's true for the Armenian government. And they can't sit in the waiting room hoping for ratification indefinitely. This process has already gone on for more than a year. The protocols actually were finalized in February of 2009. They were initialed in April. They were finally signed in October. You don't sign a treaty unless you have the intention of ratifying it. And in fact, there are some international conventions that require signatories to apply the spirit of the treaty even before ratification. So I don't think this can be treated as an open-ended process.
Well, just as a matter of fact, there are all kinds of treaties that are signed and not ratified.
Exactly.
And just take, for instance, the Convention on the Law of the Sea.
Do they go into force if they're not ratified?
Yes, but that's because it's a multilateral treaty. There are also many bilateral ones that do not. So, I mean, it's a problem. But
I mean, I think we all agree that there is the danger of the Armenian side cutting its losses and walking away from this, which is why I think next week is going to be crucial. Also in my paper mentioned a lot of discussion about gestures that the Turkish side could make to reaffirm its commitment to the process without ratifying the protocols, which would keep the process alive, and we can get back to it next year.
Okay. Yes. And can you?
Thank you very much. Berkan Pazarcı, I'm counselor at the Turkish Embassy. I think we should focus rather on positive developments right now, as the process, as Mr. Barkey mentioned correctly, is still alive, and we are trying to keep it alive. And the expectation that Turkey makes some positive steps in order to reiterate its commitment to the process has already materialized. The delegation of Undersecretary Sinirlioğlu to Erevan was for that purpose. He actually delivered the messages of the President, the Prime Minister, and the Minister of Foreign Affairs, and also gave a letter, reiterating our commitment to the process. And I think this is very, very important. So we are much better off compared with before the signature of the protocols, before the signing of the protocols. I think the launching this process, I can still say that launching this process has been beneficial and a positive development in itself. But we should maybe follow a more quiet diplomacy. We should not allow ourselves to be carried away by the speculations created in the media. Just picking up a statement of the Prime Minister or the Armenian authorities and focusing on that wouldn't really be a very constructive approach. I think also I don't agree with the fact that the diaspora is totally against the normalization between the relations. I also agree with Mr. Tom Duval that Armenians who are living in dire economic conditions in Armenia are more supportive of the normalization process because they are the ones who are under living under very difficult economic situation. They are basically quite isolated there. I believe that actually if we don't get stuck in what happened in the past or trying to impose each other's memories to each other, we have better chances to succeed. I would like to make a last comment about the definition that Mr. Phillips has just mentioned regarding during the TARC Commission's work. You said that there was the intention to kill more than one people. I think this is very simplistic. I haven't worked seen the study itself, but if you look that that lens. Also, what the Armenian gangs did in the Ottoman territories at the time was a genocide because they had the intention to kill people. And don't forget that one quarter of the Ottoman population perished during the same period. Therefore, I mean, this is not a definition of genocide. This is not a definition that anyone in the international, involved in international law would accept. And I think, more importantly, we should not focus on that. We should focus on dialogue and creating a more fruitful environment for moving ahead. Thank you very much.
Okay. In the back, next to Kerry.
Thank you very much. My name is Varjan Nerses, and I'm from Armenian Embassy. Just wanted to reflect on a couple of points that was discussed here. First of all, on this issue of so-called linkages, one on being on Nagorno-Karabakh conflict that is often tried to be kind of exploited around this. Just to reiterate that throughout this entire negotiating process between my government and Turkish government, there has been not whatsoever linkage and also reference in these protocols on the Nagorno-Karabakh conflict. So these are totally separate issues, and any further attempts, be it by Turkey or any other government, to try to link those issues, it's totally counterproductive. And as we indicated in the past, it's gonna it's gonna drive those two processes to fail simultaneously or consequentially, God knows. The second issue is the issue on the genocide. Just to reiterate that my government view genocide recognition and Armenia-Turkey normalization process, that my government views those processes as totally separate issues. Just as recently as a couple of weeks ago, my president reiterated his views and the Armenian people's views on the Armenian genocide issue in the desert of Deir Zor in Syria. And I don't need to repeat those opinions, I think, here. Everyone knows them very well. However, on the normalization process, our intentions and our approaches have been clear that Armenia has entered into this process honestly with clear intention to normalize its relations with Turkey, to open the borders and communication between two peoples without any preconditions. And that remains so. We have fulfilled all our commitments. Unfortunately, in the terms of the ratification of the process, Turkey has delayed it for unclear reasons or putting preconditions there. But my government also has indicated its willingness to continue the dialogue and discussions. But, of course, as we have indicated earlier, that cannot be an indefinite process of continued discussions. There should be some concrete results and substance for our government to be ready to engage in it. Without concrete results, it doesn't seem meaningful to continue that discussion. And once again, I think the representative of Turkish embassy mentioned about the so-called dire conditions in Armenia. I just want to make sure or invite one day, maybe through open border, the Turkish representative to Armenia to assure that even if there is a dire condition, although there is no dire condition in Armenia, but no one in Armenia would, in its mind, try to exchange the issue of the genocide recognition with the dire condition or with economic situation. It's only an intention in Armenia to move towards 21st century together, to move and to reconcile our differences. But having said that, the issue of genocide in no one in Armenia will, consider that it needs to be changed instead of stepping back from genocide. Thank you.
I'd just like to take one prerogative as moderator. I think we've had now statements on the official side from both sides. So I would like to try to direct the next discussion to the extent we can to probing a bit the views of the panel rather than statements. So with that sort of idea, could I go ahead? Yes.
This is a question directed to Henri, but also Tom may be able to address it. When people discuss...
Could you identify yourself?
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm Ron Linden, Transatlantic Academy. When people discuss a possible settlement in the Middle East between Israelis and Palestinians, they always say, well, the Israeli government can't do it because it's weak. It's in a weak coalition. The coalition would fall apart and they can't move forward. If you look at the Turkish-Armenian reconciliation, the Turkish government is not weak. 47% in the last elections, a dominant position inside and outside parliament. And it's true that, as you said, Henri, the elections are in 2011. But there will always be upcoming elections. My question is, from a political point of view, this should be the strongest moment, the moment when the Turkish government should be able to move forward and not, as you said, panic in the face of opposition, since they're unlikely to be weakened. So why haven't they?
Ron, I knew you were going to ask me that difficult one. Look, first of all, weakness is a question of perception, right? And it is also, it isn't that they see themselves as being weak. I think that they have overloaded their agenda. They have too many things they would like to do. And this one elicits a great deal of opposition within the party itself. And that's the trick. It isn't that they have, yes, they have a commanding majority in parliament, but that doesn't resolve the problem of in the party. The party, all Turkish parties are authoritarian parties. I mean, the leader decides, essentially everybody follows suit. But still, you don't want to create fissures when you don't have to. So I think that's part my problem. I think they were also taken aback by the Azeri opposition, and they also trying to calculate how this will affect the relations with Azeris on the question of oil and gas, obviously. But beyond that, you're right. I mean, I think it's a very legitimate question. I mean, they could have pushed it if they wanted to. But maybe the gentleman representing the Turkish embassy can explain it. But that's I don't have a very good explanation for it either, except that they perceive themselves as doing that, and they're going for elections, and they're already in election more than they're campaigning.
Okay, John, take the
microphone. Thank you, John Evans, formerly the State Department. Just a couple of comments, and I particularly want to address David. About the legal finding that was conceived of by the TARC and then carried out by the International Center for Transitional Justice. I agree with you, David, that this was a breakthrough, and it you were right that you pissed off both sides. And the up to now anonymous author of that surprised both sides. But it was a very good piece of work, even if its credibility is a little bit undermined by the fact that we don't know who wrote it. And I've had some Armenian Americans say that they think the State Department wrote it, which I'm sure is not the case. But in any case, we have to respect that. I was surprised that you talked about a definition of genocide being used by the creators of that document. In fact, the genocide definition that they used is that of the convention. And the point that you didn't mention is that the finding was simply that some of the perpetrators had the requisite genocidal intent, not that the entire state did or anything like that. And I wondered if you might address that. I think that ultimately for the resolution of these historical questions and legal questions, whatever happens in the next few years is going to approximate what your group did. It may not be exactly that, but both sides have gone through this process, and it comes very close, it seems to me, to being some kind of a, if not Solomonic, then at least reasonable proposition. Thank you.
David, you want to?
Briefly, yes, the finding did use the term some of the Ottoman leaders. While I can't identify the author, I can say absolutely it was not the U.S. government. And I think your overall assumption is correct. You know, the full potential of the legal analysis is something that hasn't yet been realized, and it will endure in the history of discussions around these issues and represents a potential benefit that both sides can use to their advantage.
Yeah. Yes, right here.
Thank you. I'm Emil Sanamian. I'm with the Armenian Reporter. A quick observation regarding the role of the resolutions. I wanted to disagree with Tom on what in fact impact they had in Turkey. It seems like, from my experience, from observation in Turkey, the issue of the resolution and the recognition of the genocide is much more pertinent in Turkey than any issues related to Armenia. So if, in fact, the resolutions and third-party opinion on this issue have had this impact in Turkey and have pushed this process, as Mr. Barkey talked, pushed this protocols process, shouldn't there be more resolution? Shouldn't there be more statements, third-party opinions to get Turkey, you know, to reconcile with its past?
Maybe Henri should address this question more than me. My impression is that what's been going on the governmental level, there's still very much an level of erection of angry denial to these resolutions, that they become political collisions, they don't help the process. Whereas within Turkish society, more generally, a few people have broken the taboo, Hrant Dink or Han Pamuk. Hrant Dink was specifically opposed the idea of foreign parliamentary resolutions. He said it wasn't helpful. And, you know, he was my guide in that opinion.
David?
Just as a point of fact, the annex doesn't call for the creation of a historical commission. The annex calls for a dialogue on historical issues for the purpose of confidence building. So there's nothing specific there that would suggest a formal process for studying archives and coming up with some sort of definitive conclusion about whether the events do in fact meet the definition of genocide. And I can say from my visits to Armenia over the years that there's no Armenian politician who can last a day if he accedes to a process that questions the veracity of the genocide. So the language of that annex was deliberately ambiguous. I think that just as we saw with the Helsinki Final Act, parties tend to invest their expectations into interpretations of the language. And clearly there was an expectation in Turkey that there would be a mechanism established to evaluate the credibility of Armenian claims and the claims of others.
Okay. Henri?
I think you are slightly misrepresenting what I said. I said there were two reasons for the Turks going ahead with it. One was the immediate practical, the April 24th, statement by the president. Yes, but what I was trying to also say, that this is really part of a longer-term thinking that the Turkish government was engaged in order to essentially dissociate Turkey from the question of genocide, because it was affecting its persona, its the way it was being perceived internationally and its ambitions internationally. You can't be associated with a genocide and and claim the role you want to claim. So that's the overall. And I think irrespective of all events, I think the Turkish government was planning to somehow figure out a way of normalizing relations with Armenia. They misplayed their cards internationally. I mean, there's a little bit of overconfidence, and that also goes to Ron's question earlier. I mean, the Turks made mistakes in the sense that they were overconfident about their ability to politically manage this process, and they didn't manage it well, right? So that's why we are where we are. And so, but in terms of genocide resolutions creating, you also have to put things in context. Look, for the Turks, for a very, very, very long time, not only there was no Armenian genocide, it was always the reverse. Right? That's what we were taught. You were taught in schools. And so you have to give it some time for society to understand, to appreciate that even something happened. Forget about calling it genocide or not. Right, that major events did take place where lots of people died, and it wasn't pretty. Right, so just like Turks for a long time did not even know there were Kurds in their own country. I mean, this is a major opening that's taking place in Turkey, not because of this government, but since the 1980s, and especially since the Cold War. You have to give it some time for societies to change. At the moment, the word genocide, whenever you have a political resolution, conjures up the worst images for the Turks, and it creates a very defensive reaction. We should not necessarily be surprised. But I also want to point out something else. I mean, that how risky the genocide game can become. This vote was 23 to 22. Suppose it was 23 to 22. Suppose it was 22 to 23. Does this mean that the genocide did not occur? Right? So, you know, the politicizing this process is very, very dangerous. That's all.
Well, that's yeah. Okay. In the back? Yeah. Yeah.
Elizabeth Chulgin with Horizon Armenian Television and the Armenian National Committee. A question with regards to pressure on Turkey. Recommendations talk about, you know, talking about 2015 as a time period in order to, if I remember correctly, kind of lift pressure off Turkey for a bit. I think some of that phrasing was used. And a number of times we've talked today, I've heard speakers about looking at the ICTJ report, for example, as a win-win, kind of the Mr. Barkey talking about the stigma of genocide and whatnot. First of all, I think the only reason, and if you can comment on this, the only reason that Turkey today is dealing with the Armenian genocide is because of pressure. And in fact, the TARC that came into being, I believe it was announced in 2001, in July of 2001, came immediately after a resolution that was brought up in October of 2000. And the concern, frankly, by the State Department, instead of kind of pressuring the Turkish government at the time, but to deal with its history, rather than to create these types of type 2 diplomacy to try to move this forward. So if pressure, in fact, has brought about TARC has brought about this type of Turkey-Armenia protocols and this, that, whatever, whatever, then why should we lift the pressure or kind of punt the ball till 2015? Isn't that in fact the opposite of what we want, which is kind of lifting the pressure off Turkey to deal with this issue honestly? And just as a follow-up, I mean, in terms of allowing Turkey to have time to deal with this issue, they've had 95 years. It's not like the issue happened 2 years ago. So the question then is, 95 years later, as they're dealing with this, the concept of please give me more time and give me another 5 years to deal with this sounds a bit hollow, doesn't it?
Tom?
Well, I mean, I think Henri's sort of just dealt with your point. I mean, I think the point is not that pressure has made a difference on Turkey. Maybe it's made a difference on a few individuals. It's about that Turkey in the last 20 years has changed enormously. Turkey, not only on the Armenian issue, but on a much bigger issue for, if you're a Turk, which is on the Kurdish issue. My point about 2015 is actually, it's not about lifting pressure from Turkey. It's about reframing it. It's about pointing out to Turkey that the whole world is going to be marking the centenary of this tragedy in 2015, and where do you, Turkey, want to be in 2015? And that's so it's not about lifting pressure here and putting pressure there. It's about asking a different kind of question and pointing out this centenary is going to be there. And what do you, Turkey, want to do about it?
Okay, I would like to sort of end the questions and give the members of the panel a final minute or two each to summarize whatever they would like to say. So, Henri, can we start with you again, or would you like to go last?
I'll go last.
All right. Tom, we'll start with you then.
I think we've had a good discussion here. I don't have much to say. I mean, I think what we're talking about is some very short-term fixes which are needed, and we're literally talking about next few weeks. Prime Minister Erdogan and President Sarkozy are due to meet. I don't know that they actually have a time, but certainly a meeting is scheduled when they're both here next week, and we hope that somehow they can both find things to say which suit their own domestic constituencies to at least keep this process alive so that we can get back to it at a more auspicious moment next year. I think the key point is enormous amount of progress has been made, but if this process crashes and burns in the next couple of weeks, we'll really be set back by several years, and that suits absolutely nobody. So there's a short-term fix which is needed. But also, I do, again, come back to my central point, which is that what I find frustrating about the Caucasus, and Turkey has, as it were, been sucked into the Caucasus in this process, is that these short-term dynamics, bilateral agendas, have kind of frustrate any long-term strategy, and how there's still an amazing lack of strategic thinking for this region. And I do think there's now a much more positive context after the war with Georgia. Paradoxically, it's possible to talk to Russia, if not about Georgia, much more constructively about Armenia and Azerbaijan. Russia and Turkey now have this growing partnership. So I think it's there's a little less zero-sum thinking for the Caucasus. So it is time for a more broad interlinked strategy on the Caucasus in general, which can then set goals such as Armenia-Turkey normalization. It won't happen tomorrow, but set them for a few years down the line and move towards them starting now.
Okay. David?
Well, it seems that somehow I always get put in the middle.
You are in the middle, yes.
That's a role that I'm accustomed to. Tom, you talked about the change in Turkey over the past 20 years. I would highlight the dramatic change in Turkey as of late. Mm-hmm. And since 2003, Turkey is a transformed country. And with the failed coup in the spring of 2007, the formation of a government after elections of July 22nd, 2007, that doesn't rely on a coalition, Turkey is a very different country today than when I first visited in the late 80s. There has been a breakthrough in the rhetoric. I mean, you can talk about issues today in Turkey without getting thrown in jail or disappearing. Turkey talks about the Kurdish opening. It talks about Armenian issues. It's developed political and economic relations with Iraqi Kurdistan. This is a dramatically different setting just over the past 24 months than previously. And it's important that this transformative process continue. The best way for it to continue is for Turkey and Armenia to normalize their relations and open their borders in an era when closed borders has been replaced by a spirit of globalization and cooperation, particularly amongst allies of the United States. And that sort of leads me to my final point, which is the role of the United States. I mean, you talked about how the U.S. comported itself in the Balkans in the 1990s, it's absolutely crystal clear to me that unless the U.S. is proactive, that Turkish-Armenian relations aren't going to move forward. The fact that it took the Secretary of State's personal involvement to just bring the parties together on October 10th for signature is a testament to how vital America's role is. And whether it's working with civil society or working with governments to try to move forward with ratification and other strategies that involve civil society contact and cooperation, this is an area where the U.S. has a strategic interest and a compelling cause to become even more involved. And I hope that in the future, in order to prevent things from backsliding and consolidate progress, that the Obama administration is fully seized by the importance of this matter and works to move it forward.
Okay. Thank you, David. Henri?
I want to make three comments. One, I would like to start off with earlier when I said that when the Turkish delegation visited Armenia, the message that was given to them was that if Turkey would say, look, we have problems, we have these X, Y reasons, we're going to have to delay the implementation or at least the vote. David said, well, that's good for think tankers. Well, in fact, the message was given to them by the advisor to the president of Armenia. So it wasn't think tankers talking to think tankers or academics talking to academics. This was a deliberate message sent to the Turks to find some way to give Sarkisian some room so that he doesn't pull back on the protocols. Because I think both sides realize that the protocols are to their best interest. Both win from this. There are really no losers in this. The role of the U.S. government. It seems to me there's something a little bit disappointing about the role when we talk about the role of the U.S. government, because when it comes to Turkey, at least, it seems to me that the U.S. government pulled all its eggs in this one Armenian basket. They haven't really dealt with many of the other issues in the same way that they dealt with the Armenian question. The protocols and the rapprochement between Armenia and Turkey. And still, we are facing quite severe problems. And I do think that they will put more pressure, but I think they need to approach Turkey much more comprehensively. You cannot just pick and choose on the Turkish menu and say, okay, I'm going to focus on this because this is where I'm going to get success. And in fact, when you look at the administration's first year, the Armenian protocol signature was one of the notable successes in foreign policy. There weren't that many others. I mean, the Middle East peace process, we know where it is, and so on and so forth. So, but I do believe that you need to look and engage much more comprehensively, which leads me to my final point. Look, who was it that said, Madison, if men were angels, we wouldn't need governments? Well, not only men are not angels, but government leaders are not angels. And these things are always very difficult. There will be ups and downs, and political leaders will miscalculate, will talk, and we've seen with Erdogan. I mean, his last comment about the 100,000 Armenians kicking them out, it was probably the most unfortunate comment. And the Turks realized it as soon as he said it, because they went into immediate, you know, explanation. They really didn't mean that. He really meant something else, blah, blah, blah. But the point is people make mistakes, and political leaders make a lot of mistakes because they're in front of microphones and in front of they're under pressure constantly 24 hours a day, and mistakes will happen. And so we need essentially to figure out ways of sometimes saying, okay, so we have achieved this much. We may not get to point B right now, but it's okay if we get to it a year later. And that's what sometimes we need to focus on. Thank you.
Okay. Well, let me thank the panel. And I want to thank the audience also for a good discussion and I think a treatment of a topic which has been one of the most difficult, one of the most emotional in many cases, that I've ever dealt with in my career in a way that was very constructive and I think has put a number of issues on the table in particular ways that are helpful. So thank you all very much for coming.